This is where we let it all hang out. Let it flop. Stand and unfold yourself. Tool is my favorite band.
Did they have an E at the end?
Maybe no, they don't have an E. Yeah, that'd be like a really bad cover band. Wouldn't that be funny?
Just with an E at the end.
It's like a
O'Toole. It's O'Toole. Yeah, yeah. It should be O'Toole, and it's like slightly Dropkick Murphys.
Like just a jig. A little bit.
This is the After Dark for the John Kennedy Tool episode that we just recorded with the great Dan Baltic, author
great to be
of,
here.
Yeah, absolutely. Author back. of the fantastic, wonderful, intense, hilarious
laugh out loud. That laugh is going out loud to novel.
Punch everybody in the nuts here imminently as soon as it comes out in the next few weeks. And also co-host of the New Right podcast, which you should all listen to, interviewing some of the coolest, interesting, most interesting people on the internet right now. Did you guys just do an episode recently with Prudentialist, I think?
We did, yeah, a little while ago with Prudentialist. I was on Prude's stream this weekend, our most recent episode was with Samuel Finley, who wrote Breakfast with the Dirt Cult. Bap's favorite novel, seemingly. He's very fond of it. And that was a great one. Sam's a great guy. And we have some great episodes coming up for everyone. And thank you for having me on.
I'm glad we could get to do this. And it's tricky the way that our show kind of develops. These episodes take a while for us to get to them, so it's like people want to come on and it's like, how about 6 months from now? And it's always like they're like that's how the show works, like, you know. But so it's good. I'm so glad that this has happened, and actually it's kind of it ends up being just the right time. I feel like this will come out
coming
out, and so it's all kind of working together, so everything works out in the end. We're going to talk a little bit about, you know, After Dark is a little bit looser, but we do want to talk about a couple things related to John Kennedy Toole's sexuality, whether or not he was gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But it's interesting nonetheless, I think, just because it's so murky. I mean, we have writers from 200 years ago that, like Oscar Wilde, is a couple generations before him. There's no doubt that he was at least bisexual, right?
Yeah.
John Kennedy Toole comes along late, you know, a couple few decades later, and there's like, nobody really knows for sure. Colin McLaughlin, who wrote Butterflies in the Typewriter, says he doesn't know. That's the authoritative biography, is Butterflies in the Typewriter. That one came after the one that I mostly referenced. And that's the authoritative biography. That guy says, I don't know if he was gay or not, or asexual or straight. It's not really clear. Ignatius Rising, this biography I'm referring to, part of the controversy about it is it states pretty strongly that he was. And there's a couple of things I want to read, a couple little bits. I know I've read a lot on this episode, but a couple of little things. And this is about Thelma. Ruth Kathman, this woman who dated Toole in high school. There was never any physicality to it, but they quote unquote dated. And this is about her and Ken's mom. Ruth Kathman met Ken's mother once in a tense emotional visit to Audubon Street. That's where the Tools lived at the time. Thelma didn't think any woman could be good enough for her son, a notion not unusual for a parent scared of losing control. And she received Kathman with the hostility one directs toward an intruder. In an interview for the Times-Picayune in 1980, Thelma told reporter Jeannie Blake that although women pursued her, quote, terribly attractive son, he, quote, wasn't interested in them mentally or physically. Thelma wasn't comfortable talking to Blake about other women in Ken's life, and she dismissed the possibility that anyone except her was important to him, saying, quote, boys and men have romantic feelings towards their mothers, you know. Later, New Orleans friend Rhoda Foss would recall that Thelma spoke of being, quote, the only woman my son ever wanted, unquote, to be with for any length of time. So some mommy issues, as Kevin noted right off the bat. I think Kevin could tell just by the cut of Tool's jib that there were some mommy issues going on.
I am psychic. with Art of Darkness and Artists, you could just sort of say, let me guess daddy issues, let me guess mommy.
Yeah,
9 out of 10 times, you're going to hit the mark.
Yeah. There's another. So here's another thing. So So I mentioned in the main episode that when Tool lived in Columbia, there was a he lived with this guy named Kent Tolliver, who was a friend of Clay Wright, who is the only guy who's ever been on trial in the courtroom for the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Now, when he lived with this guy in Columbia, it was a little odd, right? So they're both from New Orleans, Kent Tolliver and John Kennedy Tool, but they meet in New York. They claim that they met, that Tolliver had put up a listing that didn't say anything about being from New Orleans, but just, I need a roommate. And yet there was some vagaries, and some of the times that Kent told the story, it didn't match up. And Kent's sister assumed that they, Kent and Ken, were living together as roommates, but were in a homosexual relationship. Now, she didn't have any proof of that, but she assumed it, which suggests to me that she kind of knew that her brother was, and she sort of said that John Kennedy Tool was putting off those vibes too. So that's a little, two guys living together, college age, isn't suspicious at all to me, really. It's just on the face of it. I mean, you know, you just do that. It saves money, whatever. Not a big deal. But the fact that Kent is friends with this well-known out gay guy in New Orleans, and that they're Kent, John Kennedy Tool, and this Kent guy are kind of together, there's something slightly fishy there. I don't even want to say fishy, because I don't really care, but it's interesting to understand what Tool's deal is.
Because
even if he's straight, he's so extremely repressed that it's like painful.
Of this is against the backdrop of him never having any real girlfriends or, you know, relationships to speak of. And that is, you know, I mean, like, okay, today, you know, the crisis in masculinity, incels, all of this. Yeah, unfortunately, there are probably many men in their 30s who have not had relationships. Yeah. But that was not the case in the 1960s. That was not, or the 50s. That was not the case, especially for men of Tool station. Like, he was college educated. Like, he could have just, you know, walked into any, like, you know, shop and, like, you know, asked out a shop girl or something.
It wouldn't
have been that hard to find a wife.
No, it really wouldn't. I mean, he was
of good standing, as Spencer would say.
Right. He was 20 years old teaching at Hunter College, is an all girls college, right?
Not now, but I mean, Hunter is a New York City CUNY college now, but perhaps it was different then. I'm not sure.
I think it was an all women. I should look that
up. It could
be. I think it was an all women's college when he was there.
I mean, there was certainly, the point is, there is no lack of women in New York City.
And to this day, it was founded as a woman's college. It first admitted male freshmen in 46, but presumably it was still very heavily
predominantly.
Yeah, women. Right. Yeah, very right, interesting.
Right. Right. So, I mean, and that's the thing, like, okay, now, you know, you think about professor with students, that stuff happens. Now, at the time he was 20. So, you know, he's practically one of them, you know what I mean? Now here is the most controversial part of this Nevels and Hardy biography. Nevels and Hardy came across this guy named Chuck Layton. And Chuck Layton has quite a story to tell. All right. So I'm just going to read it real quick, and then we can maybe just move off of this. This is the big kahuna though. In the summer of 1967, Oh, so it's talking about the compartmentalization of John Kennedy Toole's life and how they might have started to kind of bleed together. Now, 1967, he's sort of given up on he's in the process anyway of giving up completely on Confederacy of Dunces, right? He dies in early 69. In the summer of 1967, there could have been just such a spillover between the different parts of his life. Chuck Layton remembers encountering a man at that time who bore a striking resemblance to the author later pictured on the dust jacket of A Confederacy of Dunces. Then Layton was a Tulane undergraduate, and because his summer schedule was not as hectic as the regular semester, he spent much of his energy honing his social life. At the time, he had a severe drinking problem. His days and nights were planned around the acquisition and consumption of scotch. Layton later said it took him years to break the cycle of self-inflicted degradation, and many memories of the 60s and 70s are a blur to him. The time he spent with the man he believes to have been Ken Toole stands out in his mind for a particular reason. One very warm summer night in the quarter, he was drinking at one of the gay bars and struck up a conversation with a man who introduced himself as John. They sat at a table together for some time, drinking heavily. Layton got the impression that John was not comfortable in the public setting. He said it was obvious that, quote, John was equally closeted, but did not cruise the bars very often. John suggested that the two men carry the party back to where he was staying in Elysian Fields, a walk of about 10 blocks. Asked why he went with a stranger alone to a part of town he's unfamiliar with, Layton answered, quote, John was obese, unkempt, and very attractive. You know, those are three things I don't put you generally in the same sentence, but whatever.
Layton was also, the first one obese?
Obese, unkempt, and very attractive. Huh. I don't know.
That's interesting.
I mean, everybody's got their thing, but usually unkempt is nobody's thing. But Layton also recognized that John was monumentally depressed, a condition Layton shared at the time. There was a great deal of conversation during the walk, but very little humor. Blah, 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 blah. John told Layton that he lived in a rooming house in the Faubourg Marigny, which is where they had a rooming house, the Toole family did, and that his family lived there as well. The two sneaked into the rear of a very old house and into John's room. It was very late. The men had sex and drank until Layton passed out. Sometime in the early morning, despite a terrific hangover, Layton left to go to class. He was thoroughly disgusted with himself and thought John did not look nearly as attractive in the morning light as he had the night before. Yep, been there, buddy. Yep. At this time in his life.
That answers the issue we were talking about earlier. Yeah. Problem solved.
At this time in his life, Layton was very concerned that his partners look handsome. Okay, whatever. Apparently, so it continues on that he comes back around to Kennedy Toole. Now, here's where it gets even past just a one-off hookup. The men didn't stay cooped up. This is another time he comes over. The men, that's Clayton or Chuck Layton and John Toole. Supposedly, the men didn't stay cooped up in the room as they had done the night before. As they moved about the house, they ran across some of the boarders. Seeing that they were all young, good-looking gay men and, quote, obviously street hustlers, Layton immediately realized what was going on in this old Creole cottage. John was picking up young male prostitutes and giving them a place to stay in return for sex, a common enough practice in the gay community. In Layton's words, quote, nothing else explains the presence of such guys as I saw coming in and out of there, as well as the weird way of it all. Now, okay, there's one other bit where Thelma apparently shows up and starts yelling at John about not cleaning, washing the dishes or something, which almost adds some realism to it in a way. Now, nobody else corroborates this story. I couldn't find anybody else talking about this except for this book. And it has been criticized that no follow-up was done on this, and it's not presented as an alleged. It's presented as a fact, just like anything else. But I'm not sure what there would be to gain for somebody to make these kinds of accusations about a dead person. Like what?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to get there's no money coming out of it, but I don't really know why somebody would make it up unless they've got some weird, they think it's their route to fame or something.
Yeah. I mean, this is an interesting point in Dunces. I mean, I don't know if you recall, but there's a scene toward the end where he strikes up a friendship with a young gay man and goes to some sort of gay party and describes them kind of tearing it up and, you know, being very gay and what have you. And, you know, that there does seem to be some element of knowledge about, you know, those types of parties and behaviors. That doesn't necessarily imply that he was a homosexual, of course, there, you know, it is evidence.
He had a friend, and we didn't talk about it in the episode, and I don't have the page number highlighted, but he did have a friend, Nick Politis, who I think was a gay guy, who took John to a gay party in the 50s because he thought John was gay. They were like lifelong friends. He thought John was gay, took him to this party, and John was extremely uncomfortable. Nothing happened, but like his friend thought he was gay enough to go to this party.
And if he was... like that is dark, like not having any relationships with women to speak of, having this really twisted relationship with his mother and then maybe never even realizing his sort of homosexuality. That is tragic.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. And then if this Chuck Layton story is this is happening right towards the end. He's completely fallen. If the Chuck Layton story is right, he's completely fallen off beyond like. He the rubber band of repression has swung the other way, and now he's like keeping a stable of ready dudes, you know, like that's pretty screwed up.
It would add a layer to the understanding of the suicide that it's not just the rejection from the book, but it's this other issue that he's wrestling with that could really be traumatic.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's not for nothing that at the beginning of Dunces, when we encounter Ignatius, he's masturbating and he climaxes to the image of his childhood dog, his deceased childhood dog. And this is like clearly, I don't think he meant to imply that Ignatius was, you know, into dogs, but it was like an act of like odd sublimation.
Not that there's anything wrong with it.
Not that there's anything year.
I'm just okay. Yeah. I'm trying to be politic. Right.
But you make a good point that it's not like a bestiality thing. It's like that's how cranked he
twisted his sexuality is that he's like he's sublimating his erotic attraction to whatever and substituting whatever it would be, man, woman, who knows, with his childhood dog. And I think we can presume that, you know, Ignatius is not meant to be a character that's attracted to dogs, and I don't think Tool was either. If we're to roll the dice, just grab
this is for the fellas, and I guess for the ladies too, on Patreon, our Patreon subscribers. If you have the childhood dog, if Spot is in the spank bag, you're gonna want to take that claw. Yeah. Like one of those little machines at the bowling alley. You're gonna want to take that claw, grab Spot out of the spank bank.
Yeah,
and move on.
And put something else in there if you got to, you know, whatever, whatever you're into. But that's
you want to swap them out.
Run Spot run.
No one should be dog pilled in this day and age.
The dog pill. No, but that is really funny, and I forgot about that. And you know that part of the novel. It's been a long time since I've read the novel. I mean, but what a stroke of, and no pun intended, but it is really masterful that he could include something like that in a comic novel and you hang with it. Like it's funny somehow. Like,
okay.
It makes me think of Joyce.
Like
that level of kind of perversion and bizarre. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of all I've got in terms of like the sort of evidence for it. And that's why I didn't want to talk about it in the main episode, because it's not sort of settled, you know. It's like, and I think in terms of a story about a guy, there's something interesting about it not being settled. And it does kind of suggest to you, like Kevin, you said, that is sort of tragic to have this thing that you never really plays out for whatever reason, you know. And he's got and then you mentioned he's going on these dates, he went on dates with women and just nothing ever happened ever.
Yeah.
Sad for them. You know, they probably were developing feelings for him. He's a reasonably handsome, he's a very charismatic man. He's a promising man about town, you know, just breaking hearts all over the place.
The faculty party circuit. Yeah. That's fun. It occurs to me there's a great play about the faculty party circuit. Why is it escaping me? Who's Afraid of It? Perfect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that play probably marked the end of the party circuit.
They had to shut him down.
It was over. You know, by the 80s, it feels like it was over. I don't know. What do I know? I mean, I've been to some of these conferences and things, and it's just the everybody huffing their own gas and whatever. Was there? That was great. And I don't know. And I'm happy not to know. I'm curious. I'm tool curious. You know, there was another thing we were going to talk about on the After Dark,
The fact that the film might be cursed.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Here are some people who were at one time or another on the list to play Ignatius Riley. John Belushi, Chris Farley, John Candy, and Philip Seymour Hoffman at one time were all slated.
What?
Riley.
Oh, Hoffman would have been. Oh my God, hurts.
I don't know about John Belushi. I think all of them probably could have pulled it off. John Belushi doesn't fit to me for some reason.
Yeah, he's not quite. Yeah.
I think it could have ended up being something where maybe they would have made a version in the 80s. Like Bill Murray played Hunter, but it really wasn't definitive. And then like Johnny Depp came and just crushed it, lived with Hunter, and just is the definitive Hunter in that movie. But then you could have had Hoffman could have picked it up. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what a pity. Yeah. What a drag.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny that too, there's a Thelma stories about early, there were rumblings about it being turned into a film, like right off the bat of publication. And Thelma is like in talking with like writing letters to lawyers and things. And at one point she offers her services to help teach the actors their dramatic expression. If John Belushi will come down to your place in New Orleans and you'll teach
he probably would have loved it. Imagine?
Yeah, yeah.
Would have enjoyed the Hurricanes at least.
Yeah, right, for sure.
Dude, when I was in New Orleans, I drank three of those. Whoa.
Yeah, no, those things were gigantic.
Yeah.
Dude. Yeah.
I showed up the first time I went to I went to New Orleans twice. The first time I went to New Orleans.
It's great that you don't remember. That's
who even knows. I showed up. I took the megabus from Austin and I showed up at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was that was a very surreal time to show up there. Like not really knowing where I was going, not having anywhere to stay until later that day. Just like, all right, I guess I'm here until 3 o'clock when I can, you know, oh my God, what a trip. Like the bars,
the bars were open though, right?
I think the bars were still open.
Yeah, they must
for
have
sure.
Done.
Yeah. And I can't remember. I did go to one. I think I got a drink. And then anyway, it was a trip. All I know is that for lunch, I sat down at like my hostel where I was staying. And
I stayed at a hostel there as well.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was just a yellow building with like lots of flags.
It might have been the same one.
It was a very well-known hostel.
Yeah.
It was on the train tracks outside of town in a kind of bad neighborhood.
Did it have a pool?
It might have, yeah.
Oh, yeah. If it had a pool, it's definitely theirs. Anyway, all I know is for lunch, I'm sitting there with a friend who I met there who we were coming in at the same time. Yeah. And they just did a crawfish broil. Like we didn't have any idea it was happening. And it just sort of happened in our laps. It was amazing. It was an amazing day, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
watching
I mean,
the
just
sun
like
come
everyone
up over Pontchartrain. And yeah, it was great.
Drinking in the street. It's just kind of like everything's just happened. You're just
crazy. Yeah.
We went down to New Orleans in 2020 during the plague and to get away. We went down during Halloween. Was it 2020? I think it was. And we had our little baby son, and we arrived at an Airbnb in Treme, and the woman who was renting it to us came into the main room. We were a little bit early, And she said, "I'm so sorry. I'm in the middle of evicting somebody. And the police may come around because her boyfriend is making threats. Do you still want to stay here?" And I'm like, "Hey, buy the ticket, take the ride. We're in New Orleans. Let's do this."
Yeah.
So the woman who was being evicted was helping clean, and she looked like she'd had a few spins around the pole, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah. And they finally got her out, and she was lovely, but okay, fine. This was like a shotgun. It was like a house. We had the main part of the house, but a second part of the house had been subdivided. And there's just this big long hallway. And throughout the course of our stay in this Airbnb, we found numerous streaks of blood all around. And we actually were like, we kind of into it. We're like, this is cool. We're having the real.
Yeah.
But the cop, the beat cop came and knocked on the door, and we're like, we're fine. Legitimately, and I'm not, you know me by now, you've listened to enough hours of the pod, and Brad, you know me, it's like I'm not that woo-woo. Fucking haunted.
Oh yeah.
No question.
Yeah, those were the previous tenants.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
The craziest dreams. I mean, there's something to that city that is,
that whole city is haunted,
paranormal.
Man.
Yeah, yeah, something. Yeah, something there is. Yeah,
there are some cities that are just kind of like dreamlike. They have a dreamlike quality, and to me, New Orleans has that.
Yeah,
Barcelona has that. LA, in my opinion, actually has that. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of like you're out, you're drinking, whatever, and it feels cinematic. It feels, but also hazy.
Yeah. The boundaries feel, you do feel like you could be walking down at any street and turn onto any other street somehow. Like, yeah, I remember not having any idea where I was the entire time I was in New Orleans.
a liminal space, if you will.
Indeed, liminal knowledge. Parts of London are like that too. The light in Holborn is just, there's no other light like it down by the British Museum. And it's just this energy. Hey, we crushed it. We did it after dark. We love our Patreon subscribers. Please, leave comments, engage with us. We want to hear from you. I know I'm on Patreon. Brad's on the Twitter. You can find Dan at the New Right Podcast. If you're a podcast respecter, and clearly you are because you're listening to the Patreon, please go check them out. They're putting in the work. They're getting on interesting guests.
Great episode.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, very good. Awesome, fellas. Well, that was beautiful. I'm going to put these episodes out right now. Any final words for us now, Dan? You come back on the show sometime, I hope.
I know I would love to. And, thank you for having me on. I love Tool. He inspired the novel I wrote, Nutcracker. And awesome. Your literary podcast is one of a cadre of, rising literary pods.
You're part of it too, man, with your show and the
Astral new and
AOD merger. It's all good. And
that's right.
Thank you for spending the time. I know these core episodes, it's long.
It's your whole night,
but it's worth it. We had fun.
Totally.
You did great.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
And thank you.
Man.
Thank you for slumming with our public school asses, our state school asses. I went to a highly esteemed liberal arts college.
Highly esteemed liberal arts college. And I am going to now go to sleep on my bed of feathers.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, man. I'll see you guys later. See you on the Bird website.
Bye-bye.
Bye.